Patinsche kolo vranske, de boike, patinsche kolo moi
Hello, and welcome to Keep Calm and Choir On, a podcast about the power of singing together. My name is Ryan LeBoy, and today our guest is G. Philip Schultz III. Known for fostering community and inspiring action among people of all ages and abilities, Philip Schultz enjoys a multifaceted career as an artist, educator, consultant, and speaker. He serves as associate conductor and director of learning and engagement of Vocal Essence, one of the nation's leading choral organizations right here in Minneapolis. He is also director of music, worship, and the arts at Good Samaritan United Methodist Church in Edina, Minnesota, and spends a portion of his summers on faculty with the University of St. Thomas's Graduate Music Education Program. The winner of the 2015 American Choral Directors Association Graduate Conducting Competition and an International Conductors Exchange Program participant, Philip believes in the transformative power of shared singing experiences. He currently lives in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, with his wife Michelle and their two children Malachi and Lydia Grace, and joins me now for the final episode of our very first season. Philip, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm so happy to be here, Ryan. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, I definitely wanted to get you on our first season, and I think my students and our listeners have a lot to learn from having you on the show today.
Well, thanks again. And you know what? I'm really proud of the work that you're doing, the way that you're adapting and creating this platform for your students to learn about artists and to engage in this art form of podcasting and whatnot. And congratulations on this first season, so to speak. It's really exciting.
Yeah, thank you. It has been very exciting. It is certainly a labor of love, podcasting. It might sound nice when you're listening out there in the listening world, but on the editing end, it's quite a bit of work. So I'm happy to do the work and happy to share stories like yours and our other guests so that our students and listeners can learn more and still feel inspired and passionate about the power of singing together.
Wonderful.
As you and our listeners already know, we have a series of questions for you today from my students at North Hennepin Community College. They're wonderful. This is their final assignment, Philip. So you're the final. I hope you feel pleased with that. So they came up with some really great questions to ask you today, and we'll go through those. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of that, I'm curious to touch base. How are you doing?
Thanks for asking that. I think every conversation should begin with how are you these days, right? Mm-hmm. I am blessed to say that my family, my immediate family, is healthy and well. Mm-hmm. My parents and in-laws are all doing well and healthy. And just to be perfectly honest, I've been using this time as a way to grow as myself, to look inward, but also to provide ways to connect people together outwardly through some things that we'll talk about later that we're doing during this time. But I feel really connected to people in new ways, and that's exciting.
My students and I have a sense from reading your extended biography that you have been making music your entire life through. We read, for example, in your biography that you had your very first solo singing at church when you were just 3 years old. And I also know, my students don't know this and our listeners don't know this necessarily, but I also know Michelle, your wife, is a music educator. And so what does a day in the life of the Schultz family look like?
The funny thing is that before we were in our sheltering in place, we would make music, at times mm-hmm. with the kids, but not as intentionally as we are making it together now, surprisingly, mm-hmm. because of doing music all the time mm-hmm. for a living. I would often come home and not want to touch the piano, not want to listen to a song. It's let's just talk. Let's just eat. I love cooking, as you know. Mm-hmm. So let's cook up something and kind of take our cares away from that. But no, in all seriousness, we love music. Music is a part of our fiber and our being. Mm-hmm. It's a way of connecting us mm-hmm. As a family and connecting us to others. So seriously, you can see Lydia sitting down at the piano sometimes. And Lydia Grace is 2 years old for our listening audience. And she will just sit down at the piano and start banging away. Or if Michelle or I are at the piano playing a song, she just starts dancing. And then the six-year-old Malachi comes around and starts dancing, and it's a little dance fest. in our home. So I would say that's really the biggest way that I see music in our family is we just break out in spontaneous dance. And I'm not the dancer in the family, but the other three start going and then I just have to join in too.
Yeah, you can't be a wallflower, Philip. And I don't know if in knowing you the way that I do, I would ever categorize you as a wallflower.
Probably not.
I have a question for my student, Josie. Are your kids into choral singing? And we'll just say singing because they're kind of young to be singing in choirs, but maybe. How do they do with that?
Yeah, they are into singing. So Malachi sings in the church choir with Michelle, his mom, as the mm-hmm. choir director. So that was really interesting at first because he didn't want to really engage for a while. Mm-hmm. And towards the middle of the year, just before we were going to the time of not having weekly rehearsals, he really blossomed. Mm-hmm. And loved singing in the church choir and kind of being a leader at age 6. Lydia Grace, being 2, loves to just open up and echo and imitate what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So she has a singing voice also. I think she's the one that's going to be the one to study music later.
Oh, you think so?
Of the two of them. Yeah. Malachi will be involved, but he's got so many other gifts and skills. I don't see music being the top of the list, but Lydia is an artist in every way.
So you've already mentioned a couple times too that faith informed a lot of your childhood and the activities of your youth. And I know you work at Good Samaritan in Edina. So faith still continues to inform how you approach the work that you do. So I have a question from my student Kimberly who asks, how do you feel your faith has influenced your music career?
Yeah, I wouldn't be a musician if it weren't for that faith journey. In all honesty, that solo at age 3 was morning sun like the creation, except it was up an octave. Like, I still remember that particular solo and just all those experiences singing in church. To me, church was singing. Everything that I know, I say this a lot, everything that I've learned almost comes from a song, and especially with my faith background. So it sustained me. It has inspired me. It has given me courage to do things that I would have never done before otherwise. So the faith journey is essentially connected to and inextricably wound up in my musical journey. I learned a particular style of singing growing up in a missionary Baptist church in Georgia. So 100% African American. We sang the spirituals. We sang gospel music from, you know, the James Cleveland, Aretha era through what was contemporary back in 1994 when I graduated from high school. And then we also sang anthems by composers of African descent. And so being able to move back and forth between styles was wonderful on the weekends. But then I also joined other organizations, my school choir, community boy choir, where we were singing in faith communities too. So on a regular occasion, I would sing in a Jewish synagogue or at the Lutheran church and got to see other people worship differently and sing other repertoire with different styles. And so I knew singing was a very important part of my development as a human being.
I love what I heard you say when you said, everything I've learned through a song.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I can, because the interesting thing is, you know, my faith journey has also evolved. It's interesting that you asked me there, can you say a little more about it? Because I realize the way that I choose repertoire really starts first with what do the lyrics have to say to us? And in every particular program that I'm working on, there has to be some song or a set of songs that are about us working together, appreciating each other, respecting and what's the word that I'm looking for? Valuing each other. And so that's my relationship with choral music, is looking for themes and threads that kind of take us along that way. And that all evolved because of, you know, the singing in church to begin with.
So you've already talked a little bit about growing up in a Black church, in the Missionary Baptist Church in Georgia. And so I have a few questions along the lines of what it is to be a Black classical musician. And my first question is going to come, or our first question is going to come from my student Daniel, who says, I've never really had to deal with any racial prejudice, being that I'm white. Have you ever faced racial discrimination in your line of work or from your fellow choir members?
I would say that the one place that I personally have not faced a lot of discrimination is in my work in music, especially in the formative years. in high school, I was looked upon as the class leader, the mm-hmm. choir leader. Miss Boniker, Pat Boniker, who's like a second mom to me to this day. Whenever I go home, I still go visit her. Mm-hmm. Everyone knew that I was her favorite. Like there was no secret that, you know, Philip was her favorite. And so that was both good and also problematic. but because of that, people looked up to me and I think they respected the musical gift that I had and the way that I tried to bring everyone in. So, and it was a school that was 90% not Black. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was in that minority there, but it didn't feel like it at school. Mm-hmm. I was aware of it, but it didn't feel like it. And then in college, the same thing. I was not looked upon even in Georgia in the 90s as a Black man in a field. I think it wasn't until later in my career that I really became more aware of the disparities mm-hmm. between the number of musicians who are professional who are Black versus those who are white. I mean, let's just mm-hmm. name it, right?
Right.
Beginning to see how it was mostly in a white art form, both in the pieces that were performed, the composers, contemporary, and the historical composers that we lifted mm-hmm. up.
Right.
They're also male, so that's a whole nother issue, as you know. I started to make it a conscious point to be able to balance how can I bring a spiritual or a gospel number the same credibility that I bring to a Mozart concert aria mm-hmm. or a Schubert lead or in choir, you know, a piece by Beethoven.
Right. They both have integrity and merit.
They do. And the way you learn one with aural skills, with spirituals and gospel music, you learn it through the ear, is a skill that you can develop and nurture. As you know, Ryan, you're fond of this too. Mm-hmm. And to say to people, this is a skill that's equivalent and as important as learning to read the notated music. But the other thing I'll say about this, Ryan, is that there is great classical music by people of African descent and Latinx descent, and you just name it, right? That we are just now beginning to present and perform more of. And so that has become my passion in the last 10 years, is to find ways to highlight these amazing composers who compose in that air quote classical style,
right?
That are Black, so people can go, okay, there's more there than I thought. I need to dig deep and learn more about them.
You know, I really appreciate what you're saying, because so often when we're talking about Black musicians in the choral world, the first name that immediately comes to mind is Moses Hogan, who mm-hmm. I do not want to speak ill of Moses Hogan at all, because I do love the music that he gave us. Mm-hmm. You know, but we think of Moses Hogan, we think of H.T. Burley, but there are so many other Black and brown musicians who, even in the time of Mozart, were writing yep. music.
I was going to say, our friend Jose Mauricio Garcia.
Yeah. So I want to loop the conversation back just a little bit to talking about being a young Black musician. Growing up, you said that you felt like you were pretty widely accepted mm-hmm. in your high school experience and in college as well. And so I sort of want to flip the script on Dan's question that he asked before and ask you, did you ever feel a sense of the burden of representation as one of the few Black males in the room?
Looking back on it, I probably should have, but I didn't feel that burden of representation because I didn't know any better at that time. The way that my parents raised me, it was just to treat each other with kindness and to speak your truth mm-hmm. And stand up for yourself and just keep moving forward.
So then fast forward to present day, we're both living in Minnesota. We're both non-white people. And you are one of the leaders of one of the most prominent arts organizations in the state. And the state of Minnesota, factually, is one of the whitest states in the country. So mm-hmm. as you're doing all of this great groundbreaking work that you are and innovating in the way that you are and giving voice to, as you mentioned, other Black composers from across the ages, do you feel that burden now? Do you feel burdened differently than when you were younger?
Yeah. Well, now I'm mindful of the fact of letting people know I don't speak for the culture that I'm a part of. Uh-huh. You know, my voice is one voice that stands on the shoulders of many voices that surround me. So it's very clear to say from my experience, here's where I am, but let's talk to others. So I'm really mindful now of trying to make sure the work that we are doing at Vocal Essence in particular is work that is with people, not just for people. And so now it's about the representation that I feel is, or the burden that I feel rather, is of making sure we're asking the right questions to the right people so that we know the programming we're doing has a chance to have the impact and the outcome that we want it to.
Yeah. And I appreciate what you were just saying. It sort of comes back to this proverbial language of teaching a man to fish versus giving a man a fish, right? Mm-hmm. That this audience, especially as we who are looking at diversifying the choral field, right? Rather than just going into a Black community and saying, here's the gift of classical music, right? What I hear you saying is Vocal Essence. And I remember being part of this, this like large committee that was sort of shaping these conversations too. And that was a really cool process to be on the inside of. But truly, you're all asking yourselves, how do we do this with them, not just for them?
Because
they don't need a handout. What they need is a stage.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And there's already so much there that we don't know. Mm-hmm. So let's go find out what we need to know and then figure out, well, what you have and what we have. Oh, we can mesh this together and create something really meaningful for all of us involved.
Philip, I know that one of the things my students are most appreciative of from your biography is how candid you are in naming your struggles with mental health, both as a male and as an African American. So I have a question first coming from my student, Caitlin, who asks, do you feel that that feeling of being viewed as weak in regards to your mental health is an extension of toxic masculinity as a whole, or is it more cultural being an African American male?
Wow, that is... an insightful question, and one I haven't thought about in relationship to my own challenges with mental illness. What I remember the most about the period of darkness, as I like to refer to it, when I was at the lowest point, was this feeling of helplessness and not liking that. And so I don't think there was a toxic masculinity thing going on for me personally, but I do think there was a cultural thing because my family and the communities that I was in, that I grew up in, we didn't really talk about mental illness.
Right. Well, you say you grew up near Fort Benning, so, you know, military base, you keep buttoned up.
Yeah. And in the Black community too, I think it's just, I don't know, maybe we just didn't know. And I'm speaking from my experience. So maybe we didn't want to name it as a real thing. Mm-hmm. You just kind of, you know, either go to your prayer closet and you pray about it, you kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you make it better. And trying all those things, none of that worked, and it just kind of made it worse. And like I said, this is a very short, concentrated period of time going from something that probably had been brewing, you know, throughout my life, but it took these sets of experiences to catapult it into a place where it then dominated my relationship with the world and with people around me. So it really was the sense of not naming it, which I attribute to my community sphere growing up in, that was the biggest challenge, just to get to the place of naming that going to seek help was not a punishment. You know, am I going to send you here? Am I going to have to send you here? You know, it was a punishment to go to a facility rather than a way to go and recalibrate and then come back refreshed and renewed.
The way that we say things really matter. And the idea of being sent off, shipped out somewhere to get fixed, right? That I would imagine that that would be very painful.
Or not come back, not knowing if you're going to come back, because I was in that darkness of, this is the end. I'm thankful for that question because it does make me look internal here now, you know, 12 years removed from that experience, to kind of process how, you know, Ryan, you know that I work with lots of young people.
Yes.
Currently, and seeing their own struggles with mental illness, making sure that my language and my response and support is nurturing and affirming their search and their quest for wholeness.
Right. Because I mean, and you know, the communities that you're engaging with primarily when you work with SOTA, the Singers of This Age through Vocal Essence, or, you know, similar to the work that I did when I was with Communication, the Children's Choir I helped to co-found over in St. Paul. it really makes a difference when they hear the gentle questions and care coming from a male role model, male or female student, period. But I mean, it just really was something that was very impactful for me because I had never really considered myself to be much of a role model for someone. I sense that, Philip, similarly to in your story, you're kind of paying it forward.
Absolutely. Because as you know, if you look at them funny, they think something's wrong and you have to kind of watch every look and every word because they do look at us as role models, as extended parents. And it's a great, great gift, but it's a great responsibility too.
So you talked before about how you refer to this period in your life as a dark place. And I have a question coming from my student, Marie. Struggling with mental health in a community that denies its place is an even bigger burden on someone. How has music helped you returning from those dark places?
Yeah, as I said earlier, that music is a soundtrack for our lives. So I can remember one of the, I'll back up a step here and be a little more transparent just about what was going on in the sense of I was having panic attacks that I could not explain. And so here I am leading a choir that's singing the snow chorus for the Nutcracker in December and doing all these other things. And so every day I would get in my car and I would have a panic attack. I couldn't go 15 minutes without these panic attacks, not knowing what was going on. And so they progressively kept happening more frequently. The one thing that had a chance of soothing me for a while was if I listened to certain songs. And there's a song that I actually talked to you about, Ryan, that we're not going to talk about on the show today for time, but it's called Hold Me, Rock Me. Calm and easy. Hold me, rock me deep and wide. I've got a home on the other side. That was the thing that would kind of, at the same time, bring me back to some groundedness for a while, but also upset me wondering, am I ever going to get to do this again? Am I ever going to get to conduct that group and make that kind of music with other people again? So the music carried me through that dark period. The music kept singing and ringing and playing in my head.
It's the handle. Art thou troubled, music will calm thee. Art thou weary, rest shall be thine.
Exactly.
Yeah. I remember, you know, that funny that I mentioned that particular piece because I remember I did that with communication. And given the context of where I was teaching, not the piece you would necessarily choose to work on with them. And what I'll say is one of the most impactful pieces we sang together.
You gave them a soundtrack. I'm telling you, there's something in that language of you gave them something they can come back to 10 years from now, 15 years from now and sing, rest shall be thine.
I'm glad we're talking about this because it's Mental Health Awareness Month. It's a really important time. We should be talking about mental health all the time. But if there is a time that is sort of dedicated for this conversation, it's right now. So I'm glad that we have you on right now. And I'm very glad that you're talking to us about it. We know that mental health is a lifelong issue, right? That, you know, you referenced that this event that sort of triggered for you, Philip, 10, 12 years ago. I'm sure there are moments that you still feel that today. So my student Ben asks, are there times now when your mental illness comes back? And if so, how do you deal with it?
Yeah, it's a good question from Ben. And the irony of this is this podcast is the first time that I've really talked widely about it. I've shared with my choirs. So my choir members know my story and we talk about it. But I've not talked openly about it in the public forum. And I'm glad to do that here on this podcast. Yes, it is a constant battle. But for me, the biggest thing was change of behavior and finding ways to have therapeutic interactions in my life. You know, talking with someone was one of the things. But as a musician, as a creative person, taking time to tap into creativity, taking time for wellness, which is why, and Ryan, you know this, I work out every single morning.
I know.
Seven days a week.
You get on the treadmill, you do your kickboxing. Yeah.
Exactly. Body weight boot camp. When I can get back to the gym, I'll be lifting weights again. And I jokingly tell everybody I work out so I can eat what I want. But really, for me, the reason I work out every day now is because I realize once I introduce that back to my life, that was my coffee. That's my mood stabilizer. When I do it first thing in the morning, the rest of my day has the best potential for being successful. I find that when I'm alone with my thoughts, sometimes in the evenings or if I'm up late at night, if I'm not balancing, that's when I get dangerously close to teetering back into places of not so much darkness, but of despair or of questions. And so like all of us, the feelings are there and the feelings are real. When I first was diagnosed and realized what had happened and was on medication, I was frustrated because I felt that my feelings were muted. Everything was on mute and I couldn't feel as deeply as I had felt before. And that was the scariest period of time because I was back in the work world within a month. It seems like it was a long time. Right. I was inpatient for a week and then did outpatient from my home going back to the same place for about 2 weeks. And all the while I was starting a new position working in a beautiful church in Atlanta, Druid Hills Presbyterian, getting to know these people, not wanting to share what had just happened totally, but also letting them know me. And yet I can't feel deeply. And you know, how do you make music when you can't feel deeply? So it was a scary time.
Is your profession. How do you do that?
I mean, it was weird. And the way I can think about it now is being on mute. My life, my feelings were muted. But eventually over time, the feelings came back and I could feel more deeply. And so now I'm able to kind of discern if my thoughts are going somewhere where I think this is not just I'm frustrated or I'm sad. This is a thought that could lead me down a spiral. I have ways to work through that. And I'm blessed to say that doesn't happen often. I was never suicidal or anything like that, but it was despair and it was deep loss and deep guilt. And I've been able to address that by being creative, by singing, by writing songs for myself. Some of them I share with the public, some of them I don't.
Well, actually, at North Hennepin, we sang one of your songs this winter.
That's right. You did Rise Up Shepherd, didn't you?
We did. They loved it. My students loved that.
Oh, that's a fun one. That's a fun one. And I think that's one of the things I'm learning in this time that we're sheltering in place. I've been shortchanging myself and the people in my sphere of some of the gifts that I have to offer. I've been writing some inspirational poetry and things like that that I'm sharing on the Take Five segments. And then some little songs that are bringing us together. We're both big fans of Melanie DeMore. Gotta love Melanie.
Yes.
An amazing vocal activist and community singing leader who brings people together. You don't need a word sheet when you sing with Melanie. You just sing with her.
That's right.
And so I'm trying to create some of my own songs like that because I don't know, there's just something about that resonates with me naturally of, hey, sing with me. Echo sing with me. So to Ben's question, that's how I'm working through it. Is by continuing to take care of my health, my diet, but also being creative every day and just being intentional about how I balance my life.
Yeah, it sounds like, again, you refer to it as a darkness in your life. And it's not like you no longer find yourself in the darkness, but now you have a flashlight.
Yeah. It's like I don't go into the darkness all the way now without my light, right?
Right. And one very important battery for that light is music.
Absolutely. Music, family, faith, food, exercise. Five batteries.
Another formative experience for you that you've already kind of alluded to was when you were working at Druid Hills Presbyterian Church. So as I understand it now, that job came on the heels of your mental health crisis. And so you were just starting that job. You were working at Druid Hills and you started this thing called the Druid Hills Project. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So Druid Hills is in Midtown Atlanta. It's a neighborhood. And this Presbyterian church sits right on the corner of Ponce de Leon, as we call it in Atlanta, Avenue. And on our campus, we had a men's shelter where men who were experiencing homelessness would live for periods of time and receive counseling and work training. We also had a community church, Mercy Community Church, that used a part of our facility. And they work mostly with people experiencing homelessness too and offered meals and sessions. And this was brand new to me, coming to work in the city. Most of my work had been in the suburb before that. And so being in Midtown Atlanta, I couldn't get to the building without having conversation with these folks who were on our campus. And so begin to befriend them and get to know them. And it just became a natural fit of, could we a couple of times a week get together and use music as a way to bring us into relationship with each other, mm-hmm. to acknowledge that there is a sense of humanity and a sense of desire to be better and to achieve more in each and every one of us. Mm-hmm. And I met some really dear people who taught me a lot about what experiencing homelessness is and dispelled a lot of the myths about what, you know, experiencing homelessness isn't.
In your biography, you say that it's a justice-based program. And mm-hmm. with that, I have a question from my student, Shai, who says, when you say that it's a, quote, justice-based program, what exactly does that mean?
It's the understanding that, A, we are not hierarchical. Mm-hmm. There's not someone coming in on a higher level giving something to someone who's on a lower level. It means that we are all coming to this at the same plane. We are equal partners entering into a relationship where we are going to share and learn from each other and receive and give to each other. So mm-hmm. I see that justice based on one hand as acknowledging the humanity in the people that I'm working with. That was the one hand. On the other hand, the dual meaning of the word, it was to give voice to people whose voices are often silenced or not listened to, mm-hmm. to give a platform for their stories to be heard and understood and experienced in a way in community with others who might shy away from interacting with them. And so mm-hmm. I think that justice happens on both of those levels.
And I think, you know, what's great about the field that we are in is it helps us to arrive at those understandings minus the shame and judgment, mm-hmm. right? That mm-hmm. as we're breaking down those barriers for ourselves or those understandings for ourselves, it's in a community of people who are very non-judgmental.
Yeah, it's people who are also at the same time simultaneously having their little epiphany moments too, right? Yeah. And we can have those moments if we just risk engaging with people whose experiences are different than our own.
It reminds me of a quote. I can't remember exactly where I read or heard this, but somebody once said that in the arts, you enter heart first. Mm-hmm. It's giving us the ability to engage from the heart and the spirit first, mm-hmm. rather than with our minds and all of our biases.
Yep, absolutely. Boy, we need more of that these days, don't we, Ryan?
So a pretty sharp turn now. We've talked about your life away from Minnesota, and now I want to get us to Minnesota with a question from my student, Sam, who really simply asks, how exactly did you end up in Minnesota?
I realized I was at a crossroads and I needed to go back and further my studies. Like I'd always wanted to finish a terminal degree in some form or fashion. And I was at a musically, from a career standpoint, I was at a plateau. And it mm-hmm. was time. It was past mm-hmm. time. And so I started looking at schools, and I actually had another school in mind with a mentor that's still a dear friend. We were all set to go, but I also threw the University of Minnesota in the equation because of Kathy Romy and her relationship with Helmut Rilling, mm-hmm. And her work with the Minnesota Chorale, and then Matthew Mahaffey. I saw the work that he was doing. I visited the summer choir performance one of the summers we were here.
Oh, sure.
And so I was like, why not just apply to the University of Minnesota and see what happens there too? And sure enough, I'll never forget the day I got the call. On the same day, Michelle has an elementary school choir concert, and I was like her assistant director and accompanist. She tells me that she is pregnant with our firstborn, now Malachi. Uh-huh. And Kathy Romy calls me to say, hey, we'd like to invite you to come to the University of Minnesota and be our doctoral student for this year. Yeah. And so I was like, okay, I can be the husband of the year for the next 3 years.
That's right.
If I move Michelle to Minnesota and we have our baby here and her family's just 2 hours away, yeah. why not? You can do yeah. anything for 3 years. Little did I know that turned into me just absolutely falling in love with the arts community here, the people here, the way of life here, and then getting the amazing opportunity at Vocal Essence, and then and my church community there, the choir there, wonderful people. it truly is home, and that's how we got here, and that's why we're still here.
Yeah, and just to give you a little bit of props, you know, we both started at the University of Minnesota at the same time. I guess also to put a little feather in my cap too, the university accepts one student per year in each of the programs, the master and the doctoral program in choral conducting.
That's right.
So that's quite the compliment to you and your abilities, and I echo your sentiments. It was Kathy Romy that brought me to Minnesota. Mm-hmm. You know, she is this force in our field, and she is so eloquent and elegant and knowledgeable and as passionate about her teaching and her students as she is the music that she works so doggedly and tirelessly to create. As an homage to our beloved professor, Kathy Romy, we have to talk about Johann Sebastian Bach.
Of course.
We are under obligation to talk about it. And I'm glad that it's coming up now, because I'm realizing, looking back and listening to the other episodes of Keep Calm and Choir On so far, we haven't talked about Bach yet. So this will be another...
Are you serious?
I am so serious. We were saving it for something special, Philip. And so it's happening with you. Of the music that you brought with you today, you named that you wanted to talk about Bach's motet Singet dem Herrn. Mm-hmm. What made you want to bring this particular piece onto our program?
Well, I tell you, Bach is someone that when you work on his music, you feel like... on one hand, your soul has been cleansed. It's just been washed in the beauty of Bach. Your mind has been challenged because, A, you have so much to do as a singer, just from that physical standpoint, the production. But also your soul is quenched when you take a moment to look at how intricately he constructs the music with these melodic motives that paint the text in very profound ways, the ways that he uses counterpoint and the ways that he uses intervallic construction to bring out meaning. When you dig into that history and that analysis, it's just like a well-balanced musical meal. Singet is just so stinking fun to sing. You know, the double choir aspect is just so virtuosic. And you get to look at your colleagues across in choir two singing at you if you're in choir one, or vice versa, and you're just feeding off each other.
It's just really fabulous music that you brought with you today. So thank you so much for thinking to share this one. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned before that you love all of the learning opportunities that this music presents for you as a conductor and singer and musician. In doing some research on this, I learned that Mozart felt exactly the same way. So Mozart visited Leipzig, where this piece was composed in 1789, and apparently exclaimed on his visit there, "Now there's something you can learn from," when he heard this piece performed at the Thomasschule, which is the school connected with the church where Bach was music director. Mm-hmm. I mean, if Mozart is saying it's good, then
yeah,
it's gotta
exactly.
be.
And Mozart had some high standards, I'd say.
Yeah, for sure. So just a little bit of quick history about the piece. It's formally called Singet dem Herrn ein neues Lied, BWV 225, if that matters to you. If not, don't worry about it. And it's the psalm text, Sing to the Lord a New Song. It's a motet that was written between 1726 and 1727 in Leipzig at the Thomaskirche, where Bach was the cantor. The piece is structured in three movements. The opening movement is a quotation of Psalm 149, verses 1 through 3. Again, this Sing to the Lord a New Song. The second movement, as Philip and I have mentioned, is this more stately, grandiose, reverent hymn setting modeled after Psalm 103. And then the third movement is this really fun, fast and furious fugal movement that comes from Psalm 150, verses 2 and 6. I'd love to also just share a little bit of information about Bach. I did a little bit of Google researching, and also, Philip, I know you'll appreciate this, cracked open the tome Choral Repertoire by Dennis Schrock.
Oh, Dennis Schrock, yes, indeed.
Yeah, so here's the quick and dirty on Bach. Was born in 1685 and died in 1750, so not a very long life, but a very prolific and very successful life for Bach. Even in his time, he was very well renowned as a composer and conductor and musical leader. Comes from a long line of family musicians and studied with his father and brother early on in his life. Something I learned from the Schrock that I thought was interesting is that the tradition of studying with a family member in the Bach family spanned back almost 100 years before Bach was born.
Isn't that fascinating?
That is really fascinating and incredible and scary. I mean, talk about burden of representation.
Hello.
But Family dude business. Wasn't allowed to be a failure.
Nope.
Yeah. So he was a virtuosic musician from pretty early on, and actually secured his first post as an organist at the Neue Kirche in Arnstadt, Germany, at the age of 18. He was a super ambitious man, as evidenced by his prolific output of music, and not just the sheer amount of music that he wrote, but the quality of the music that he wrote. Very ambitious man, and both, I think, blessing and curse in his life is that he was craving more and more prestige and acclaim throughout his entire career. In 1723, he becomes the cantor at the Thomaskirche in Leipzig, like I've already mentioned. This is one of the most prestigious jobs that you can land in northern Germany at the time. And Schrock says about this particular moment, I am curious to hear your thoughts on this, Philip. Quote, numerous famous musicians applied for the position, including George Philipp Telemann, but for various reasons, most of the musicians withdrew from consideration. Is there some sort of scandal there that I don't know about?
I'm trying to think back. I'm pretty sure there's something to it because, you know, everything was highly political at that time.
Right.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and do some digging, but I feel like Bach had an inside track for some reason through another connection.
Right, because it's not saying that he like beat out the competitors. It's Schrock said that they withdrew. So I'm like, is this like a Shonda Rhimes drama in the making? So that sort of piques my curiosity about Bach today. You know, you learn something new about Bach every time you return to either his life or his music. Listening audience, you're in for a real treat. We haven't had Bach on the podcast yet, so this is a great one to start with. Probably his best known motet, Singet dem Herrn. Philip, after finishing your graduate studies at the University of Minnesota, we know that pretty soon after that, you ended up landing a position with the organization Vocal Essence, led by Philip Brunel. Can you tell us a little bit about Vocal Essence before we dive into questions?
Sure. So Vocal Essence has been around 50 plus years now, and we are a community choral-based organization that's mission is to bring people together in song. So we seek to create transformative experiences through making music together. We have a choir of professional singers, 32 singers most years, the ensemble singers, a choir of 100 plus volunteer adults, the Vocal Essence Chorus. I founded 3 years ago Vocal Essence Singers of This Age, which is an immersive arts apprenticeship program featuring students from about 20 different high schools in the Twin Cities. And then we also have Vintage Voices, which is partnerships with local facilities for older adults. And we create choirs in those places and sing with them as well.
Having sang in the Ensemble Singers a few years myself, I also know within that really succinct description that you just gave us, and thank you for that, there also are tons of projects or several really important projects for our community.
Yeah, we do a lot with lullabies for young mothers, teaching them to write lullabies for their children, the Lullaby Project out of Carnegie Hall. We also have Witness Program, which shares the experiences of African Americans and our shared cultural heritage. And so there's a school program component there, which is led by or headed up by many teaching artists from the African American community here in Minneapolis-St. Paul. And then the Conjuray program brings composers from Mexico into the Twin Cities schools to write original music for those choirs to sing as well. And there's so many other, you know, projects with composer mentorships and competitions for new music to be written as well. Again, it goes back to that simple tagline of finding ways to inspire people to sing together across the lifespan.
And not only does vocal lessons provide the opportunity, you do it really well.
Thank you.
That's one thing that I really admire about vocal lessons from my time singing with them, but also as a music educator and choral professional, just really setting the gold standard for what choral music is in our community and what it can be.
Oh, I really appreciate hearing you say that. And I think it's important that we provide people with many entryways into what choral music can be. And I also think it's our responsibility to expand the possibilities of what choral music can be in times like the times that we're in now, when we're sheltered in place and not able to gather as choir. A lot of my work is still helping people see new ways that we can sing in community and still be choir with a larger definition of that word.
You mentioned that there are a number of choirs within the vocal lessons family, and I know that you actually interface with most, if not all of them, pretty directly. So I have a student, Jackie, who asks, how does your conducting or teaching differ between the various choirs you lead?
Interesting question there. The core values remain the same. It's just in the matter of intensity and time spent in realizing the artistic vision. That's the thing that changes the most. With the professional ensemble, where you often have less time in rehearsal to get to be performance ready, you have to make your points very succinctly and often use your hands and your body affect to help the singers see that collective vision and realize it. Whereas with singers of this age or vintage voices, there's a lot of hands-on teaching about how to produce the sound. Sometimes you just have to start there with the mechanics of production and then move to creating the artistic response that you want to hear.
One brand new feature of your work with vocal lessons, Philip, is the Take 5 with GPS, right? Because we're calling you Philip, but we know that your name has three initials, GPS. So Take 5 with GPS. Question coming from my student, Brittany, who asks, can you dive deeper into what Take 5 with GPS is? Did you create it specifically for this time in our lives, or was it something you wanted to do?
It really was created for this time. I wanted to find a way for us to continue to sing together. I am horrified every time I hear people use the word virtual. You know, virtual choir, virtual meeting. Mm-hmm. You know, we are very real people who are interacting on platforms that may be keeping us physically distanced, but we're still socially connected. So I wanted to find ways that we could continue to connect in song. And Take 5 with GPS was one. I could sing and sing songs that people either know or that they can learn very quickly. Mm-hmm. I wanted to find a way to give some vocal nuggets and some opportunities for, you know, oral skills development so that it could cross-relate to our choral colleagues around the country who are looking for things for their students to do that's meaningful and still keeps them singing. But most importantly, I wanted to find a way to infuse inspiration, hope, and an opportunity to express gratitude each and every day.
And I loved what I heard you say before, Philip, that you sort of cringe when you hear virtual anything because we're real people. It's so true. And I thank you for saying that because I've not thought of it in that way, but it's something that I've been sensing. So I appreciate being given the vocabulary to think about it that way. I think this is a great way to wrap up our first season of Keep Calm and Choir On with Andrea Ramsey's Hope Lingers On. Philip, can you tell us a little bit about the piece?
Yeah, absolutely. So Andrea actually covered this piece from a singer known as Lo Lilly. It's amazing, amazing text of hope, inspiration, encouragement. My mother, when love is gone in our darkest hour, hope lingers on. And then it keeps going, my father, my children, the parents. It's just a beautiful expression of no matter how dark the times may be now, no matter what kind of hole you may have sunk into, there is something good on the other side. Mm-hmm. And it has this kind of gospel, and I use gospel in the generative term, not the religious term, the gospel kind of feel to it. Mm-hmm. It's really inspirational. I was talking to some friends yesterday, and they talked about front porch singing, and I love that expression. This is a front porch song.
Yeah, it's like that Appalachian kind of like old tent meeting.
You're just rocking in your chair. Too bad you can't see me. I'm rocking in my chair right now, everybody.
I can confirm it. He is.
And you hear the melody, and you automatically just start harmonizing.
It's a great piece. It's originally by a group called Low Lily. They're based out of Brattleboro, Vermont, and they're this independent folk trio. The piece comes from their first album, which was released in 2018, called 10,000 Days Like These. So we're talking about a newer piece, right? Mm-hmm. The album was released in 2018. Philip, do you know what year Andrea wrote this?
I think Andrea arranged it shortly thereafter and got in touch with Lisa, I believe is her name there.
Lisa Schneckenberger.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the recordings that we'll listen to today actually is from the Vancouver Youth Choir, mm-hmm. which is an amazing choral organization. I think you're really going to love hearing them sing. I'm sure after you all listen to it, you're going to start singing it right away. You're going to be humming it for the rest of the day.
Yeah, it's an earworm.
It for sure is an earworm. And I think Andrea does such an excellent job in honoring what is quoted on their website as the intimate, no tricks involved style of singing that Low Lily brings to us. So, Philip, can you tell us a little bit more about Andrea?
Yeah, Andrea is a force for good in the choral community right now. She is respected as an educator. She started her career teaching junior high school music in Arkansas, and then she pursued doctorate studies at Michigan State, has taught at Ohio State and at Colorado Boulder, and now she is an independent composer and clinician doing fantastic work. A lot of pieces that have this same kind of universal theme to them about bringing people together for common good or addressing specific issues of our day. She's right now completing a cantata based on the women's suffrage movement. Fantastic person. Andrea, if you're listening, thanks for all you're doing in the choral community.
Yeah. And what I love about Andrea and her music is it not only has a timely message and is very relevant to the lives that we're living today, it also is objectively good music. And when I say good new music, I also want to give another compliment in saying it's so beautifully accessible. Yes. Everybody can sing this music. She writes music for everyone, and I'm so grateful for that.
And there's still opportunities for artistry to be expressed there. And as when you hear this piece, you'll hear the moments for beautiful artistry as well as just visceral impact.
My mother, when love is gone, my mother, when love is gone, in our darkest hour, oh, playing your song, my father. When peace is gone, my father, when peace is gone, in our darkest hour, oh, playing your song, I will not hate, and I will not fear, in our darkest hour, oh, bring us here.
My brother, when it's all over, 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 it's all over,
it's been so much fun to have you on the show today to close out our very first season of Keep Calm and Choir On, but also to reminisce about our times in graduate school together and our move to Minnesota. And I just really appreciate the candor that you've brought with you in sharing about your family and your wife and what brought you here, but also your relationship to classical music as an African-American male, and also your challenges with mental health, speaking so candidly. And as you said, for the first time here on this podcast, it's a real honor that you trust us with your story and that you would share so honestly. So thank you so very much for that.
Absolutely.
Before we leave today, I just want to ask you a few questions. First is coming from my student, Maya. Was there ever a point where you felt like being done with choir or music?
Anytime you take something that you love and it becomes your primary vocation, there's a challenge that the quote unquote love or passion diminishes as you are seeking to do what you have to do to sustain a living. But for me, there's so many new areas and uncharted places or opportunities in singing that it keeps me inspired. No, I don't think I've ever wanted to be done with it. And I'm incredibly grateful that I can do this as a way to sustain my family's life and my life.
Another question coming from my student, Ben. He says, in the introduction of your bio, you mentioned your belief in the transformative power of shared singing experience. What is it about shared singing that is so transformative in your opinion?
There's a lot of research that tells us when we begin to sing together, if we're in the same room, our heartbeats begin to link up. And our baseline heart rate falls into a more relaxed and natural pace, and anxiety begins to wind down, and we emit these feelings of goodness all over our bodies. There's something powerful that is almost magical or mystical that happens when we sing together. The feel-good sides of our bodies comes to the foreground, bubbling out. Those feelings then sustain us for the next 10 or 15 or 20 minutes after we've left that shared singing experience. I felt it countless times, and I've talked with other people, whether they are singers or just a congregation at a church or a community sing, people name the same thing.
Well, Philip, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show today. I'm so glad that you could find some time away from your very busy work schedule and your family schedule to talk with me and our listening audience. I very much appreciate you, and I'm so inspired by what you had to share today. So again, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Ryan. I'm so glad you're doing this and that I could be a part today. And friends, you know, find me on Facebook or Vocal Essence, reach out with an email, let's stay in touch, and I'd love to hear how you're making music a part of your lives. And if you aren't making music a part of your lives yet and you still find yourself listening to this podcast, hopefully now you've convinced yourself that you need to make music a part of your everyday life.
It's essential work.
It is essential work. Essential for life.
All right. Well, we'll talk soon, Philip. Again, thank you very much and take care.
All right. You too, Ryan. Bye now.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Keep Calm and Choir On. And thank you again to our guest, G. Philip Schultz III. I'd like to additionally thank Christina Rodel-Sorum, host of the podcast Art More Lovely, for her help with co-producing this episode, and offer a huge thank you to my choir students at North Hennepin Community College for their thoughtful questions. If you enjoyed today's music and conversation, be sure to like and follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/choironpodcast, and stay caught up on our latest episodes by subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or your preferred podcast platform. And as always, you and your friends can find us on our website, choiron.buzzsprout.com.